Hello, everyone. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity. It is Cinco de Mayo here, 2020. And today we are going to be talking with Neil Howe of The Fourth Turning, the book that I've been referring to. If you've been watching my video series on COVID-19 on YouTube, it was back on February 20th. I actually dedicated an entire episode to the concept of The Fourth Turning, talked about the book, talked about the theory, talked about the thesis. And it's something you've heard me refer to over and over again. So what is this Fourth Turning? The reason I'm bringing it to you is that it's really important concept. In my life, I value ideas. I value wrestling with ideas. And what I really especially value is when I come across an idea that's like a rudder turn and it shifts the course of my thinking forever. And The Fourth Turning was such a book. I read it and I said, wow, it really clicks into place. And I found myself over time assembling things and data and fitting it into this framework. So it's a really useful framework for understanding where we are. And by the way, I think you need to understand this now today because we are in a fourth turning. This is a really historic period of time. And the fourth turning didn't begin with the virus, but boy, did it have rocket fuel poured on it. And so here to talk with us about this today, I'm really excited to bring back to the program Neil Howe. Neil, hey, thanks so much for making the time to be with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's get right into it. The fourth turning, what is it?
Well, it was a book that Bill Strauss and I wrote back in 1997. It was actually, there was a prior book that was sort of the foundation of the basis for our whole paradigm. It was a book we wrote in 1991 called Generations, the History of America's Future. And it was that was a big book. That was a long project that took us several years, actually. We basically rewrote all of American history as a sequence of generational biographies, collective biographies of generations. And what we showed is not only is every generation in American history distinctly different in its peer personality, its habits, its attitudes toward family, risks, civic service, and so forth, but that people were always aware of these differences, even going back to the 17th century. And moreover, these differences tend to follow a certain pattern. Generations are different, but they're not randomly different. Certain kinds of generations always follow other kinds of generations. And that these differences, these patterns associated to some of the larger historical patterns that we've seen in not only American history, but in many other modern societies around the world, even some ancient societies. You know, Ibn Khaldun and Arnold Toynbee and many others have written about this. And that is the tendency of societies like ours to have huge civic and institutional turning points. Periods of rapid transformation occur about the length of a long human lifetime, about every 80 or 90 years. You know, we go from the Glorious Revolution, the War of Spanish Succession, sort of late 17th century, to the American Revolution, to the American Civil War, to the Great Depression and World War II, and guess what? Here we are, right? Mm-hmm. We're right back there again. And the basic insight there, and this would be Arnold Toynbee's sort of generational forgetting thesis, is that during crises, we shape generations of young adults who become extremely competent at creating building and managing effective national institutions, right, that take care of the nation through times of trouble, and that these generations die off, and that these abilities are now passed on to their children, right? So in almost invariably, the generation that leads America as senior leaders through the next crisis, invariably the one that was born just after the last crisis, right? I mean, you look at Abraham Lincoln's generation, born just after the Constitution and the founding of the American Republic. FDR and all the wise old men and women of World War II and the New Deal were born just after the Civil War. And look where we are now, all these aging boomers born after World War II are fumbling around, you know, trying as best they can, and we're finding out they can't do it very well, direct America through the next crisis. But it's more important than that. It's the aging of all generations that actually pushes the country into a new mood There's another interesting pattern, which is that roughly halfway between these great civic crises, they're the great awakenings of American history. These are the great periods of cultural and religious renewal. You could say that in the great crises, we reshape our outer world of politics and institutions and infrastructure. But in the awakenings, we should reshape our inner world of religion and culture, values, right? Well, it turns out that generations, you know, these awakening periods are just as important, just as interesting when you study history. Boomers came of age during one, the late 60s and 70s. Many historians consider that America's fourth or fifth great awakening, depending on what you want to start your count with, you know, John Winthrop or Jonathan Edwards. But every generation, every time it moves into a new phase of life, about every 20 or 22 years, pushes America into, or any society, into a new social mood. And so if you think of four basic generational archetypes, right, each about 22 years long, it's about 90 years, right? So you can see how this is a sequence. This is an identifiable sequence. And we gave them names of turnings because they're like seasons, sort of like spring, summer, fall, winter. The spring season would be like the post-war era, the post-crisis era. That'd be like the post-World War II American high, late 40s, 1950s, early 60s. The silent generation famously was coming of age during that time. And these are periods when institutions are strong, individualism is weak, society feels a strong collective purpose of where it wants to go. The whole feels like it's more than the sum of its parts, you know, that kind of feeling. The awakenings are these periods when we throw off all social discipline, we tire of all that conformity, we want to become more individualistic, we want to become authentic people, right? And this is true of all the great awakenings. We, you know, we throw off the religion of works. We want to go back to the religion of faith, you know, from the collective to the interior. And these are very individualizing periods of history. And, of course, that's when boomers came of age. That was kind of their leitmotif, right? They were the generation of individualism, doing your own thing, following your own light. And as a result, as we went into the third turning, this is more the fall season. And this is when, by the way, Gen Xers are beginning to come of age. Gen Xers being the children of the awakening, kind of the throwaway kids of Woodstock. And they came of age with this third turning, which was the maximum individualism, the minimum of institutions. Third turning decades in American history would be like the 1990s, the 1920s, the 1850s, the 1760s. These are decades of incivility and bad manners when yep. when no one really cares what government or anyone else says to you. These are a low ebb of any sort of civic attachment. But history says that these third turnings always end in fourth turnings. And fourth turnings is when we suddenly realize that that kind of world is not meant for survival, right? And that we suddenly need order. We need direction. We need authority. And we are usually shocked into that realization by a catalyst that suddenly plunges the nation into a very negative mood. Suddenly big institutions, particularly individualistic market institutions, no longer seem to work anymore. And in fact, some of the big catalysts were great stock market crashes like 1857, 1929, and sooner or later, they ultimately took us into great wars, historically. I mean, total wars, not just wars, total wars. I mean, this would be the total regimentation of society. But I think it's interesting, this latest fourth turning, I think we entered in the time of the GFC, 2008, 2009. And I think we're going to be in it all the way until around the year 2030, right? So that's a good 22 years. We always predicted that in the 2020s, we'd see an acceleration. In fact, Bill and I wrote a piece back in 1991, believe it or not, Chris. This was actually the cover story for American Demographics. We did it. It's a big glossy piece on our theory of generations. And right there in the title page in bold print was saying, you know, our prediction, America is headed for a great crisis right around 2020. So you can see it there. So that was what? 29 years ago, something like that. Mm-hmm. But we always thought that the 2020s would be kind of the decisive decade. And so that kind of lays it out. I do think that the pandemic has an interesting correspondence to the turnings, not because fourth turnings are always triggered by a pandemic. They're not. They're often foreshadowed by one, as I do think that the crisis we had it from 1929 to through World War II was foreshadowed by the great Spanish flu, the great Spanish influenza of 1918-1919, right after World War I. It definitely magnified and accelerated the movement away from globalism and internationalism around the world. It heightened xenophobia in countries all over the world. It was one of the big reasons why America closed the immigration window in 1920 and 21. And the 1920s became a decade of isolationism and sort of not much liking for foreigners in America. And one of the reasons why we had such a horrible memory of World War I, right? We didn't want to go back into that. And we just generally turned anti-foreign in general. It was a xenophobic decade. One interesting thing I find is that, third turning moods are usually one of great openness, very little government control, borders are usually laxly enforced. The great immigration waves in American history have usually occurred in third turnings. I will say that one lesson of pandemics, going back to the plague of the Antonines, the plague of Justinian, the bubonic plague, that hit Europe starting in 1347, was that all of these plagues terminated eras of great openness. Because great openness is wonderful in promoting efficiency and innovation and experimentation in human societies, but they're also very good at promoting innovation and experimentation in pathogens. And we forget that 1347 was when we got the rats coming along the Silk Road, the fleas, down into Genoa, into the ports and so on. But that was after the Mongols came and opened up the whole trade route to China so that Marco Polo could freely go back and forth. This had been closed before, right? So suddenly that whole road was open. And the same way you look at these earlier periods, particularly the plague of the Antonines, was when you could go all the way from London and go all the way to India. Completely unmolested. That's when the Roman Empire had its apogee. So, and this was really pointed out by William McNeill in his classic *Plagues and Peoples*. I believe it was written in 1977. One of my great heroes at the University of Chicago, and I believe that there are many people now writing sequels to that book. But I find that correspondence very interesting and apropos right now, because it looks as though we're going into another period of xenophobia, raising of borders. Suddenly all the great powers are now at odds with each other. We're more than in just a strategic competition with China. It looks like we're almost in a cold war with China, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not unusual. This kind of follows this follows this general rhythm.
Neil, thank you for that. Just fabulous tour through that. So I want to talk about this fourth turning. One aspect of it that maybe I've overly focused on, but and you mentioned it earlier, is this idea of loss of faith in institutions. And so when we put the COVID-19 overlay on today, I think what it's done, when I said it poured rocket fuel on the situation, is I see a lot of people who had a lot of faith or some residual faith or even shaky faith in institutions, it really got shattered. And that's a really tough moment, I think, individually, personally, for somebody. Like, if you trusted the CDC or the Surgeon General or, the World Health Organization, and suddenly you have reason to call that into question. I'm seeing that as a general motif now including just yesterday reading about college students suing to get their tuition back because they didn't pay $50,000 to take a Zoom call with a professor, right? So even it's extended to this idea that maybe the institutions of higher learning have been laid bare as institutions that are more interested in money than in educating, or however that gets expressed, right? But I think that I wish if you could just talk for a minute about that theme of loss of faith in institutions, because that feels like a really powerful shift in people's narrative orientation.
Well, I don't think it's quite so much that we're suddenly utterly crestfallen and shocked that institutions don't work. I think it's rather that we suddenly realize how much we need them. Mm-hmm. That's the difference, right? I don't think anyone cared two hoots about the CDC. I mean, you know, whether they trusted it or not. Now, interestingly, the CDC, Center for Disease Control, was originally called the National Security Center for Malaria Control back in World War II. And the GI generation coming out of World War II gave it names which clearly lent its priority to national security, right? And it was designed to combat communicable diseases. And it was designed also to provide leadership for a very large network of public health workers in the United States. I don't know if you recall. I mean, I recall in as a kid, polio. Mm-hmm. And we had people went house to house. They, you know, states were well equipped with people to go house to house to track down polio infections. We used to have a large public investment in public health workers. You know, we talk about testing and tracing today. Mm-hmm. We're utterly unable to test and trace today. And forget the testing. Everyone says, well, if only we had tests, we could do it. That's only the first thing you need. Then you probably need, given the fact that I would estimate there are probably around a million people who are actively infected now, if you could measure them all. It's probably around 10 times the official count being infected every day. You would need maybe 300,000 people. And this is, you know, Scott Gottlieb and Tony Fauci, they all admit you would need an army of hundreds of thousands of people to actually have teams to actually do contact tracing. So we're nowhere, you know what I mean? We're nowhere near the ability to actually implement a containment strategy, which you wouldn't need so many people if you'd started early, right? I mean, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Taiwan, you know, they don't need quite as many because they got to work early. We would need an army, either that or we would need mitigation severe enough and long enough to get new infections way, way, way down so we could do this with a lower group. But what I mean is, we lost that ability. It's a combination of the fact that, again, you remember I talked about generational replacement? The generation that really believed that government needed that kind of extra infrastructure to handle that kind of thing if it happened, they all went away. You had all these, boomers and Xers who, I don't know, why do you need all that stuff? Why do you need all that infra? Well, all that extra spending, all that, all those people, what the hell did they do anyway? And we've got vaccines, we got all this high-tech medicine, and We can spend all of our enormous healthcare budget on, you know, pricey specialists to, you know, mend our bodies with super expensive medicines and operations. I mean, in my opinion, my generation got completely insane in how they approached healthcare. But in any case, public health, what's that? I think that's the attitude of a lot of younger generations today. We're suddenly realizing, yeah, actually, it's pretty important, isn't it? So in so many ways, this COVID outbreak has pinpointed exactly America's weakness when you consider it. You know, the populist disdain for the expert, our very decentralized federal, you know, political organization with 50 separate governors. How are you going to do containment strategy when one premise of a containment strategy is not only do you have to totally clamp down on new cases, but you need tightly watched borders? I mean, look at New Zealand. Look at all these countries, right? If you pursue containment as a policy, not only do you push a new infections way down and track them and test them all, but then you got to hugely police the borders and making sure no one's news coming in. So every single country that has an effective containment policy is policing its borders. Well, how's New York going to do that? Right? Yep. So that creates an additional problem. And I think also we have this, you know, we're very libertarian in America, which I think in a lot of cultural contexts is a great thing. I mean, I prefer to live here. I prefer to live in an individualistic country. Nonetheless, an issue like this exposes some of the weaknesses and some of the challenges, right? There are times when I think even individualists realize that you need effective top-down institutions. I think we realized that during the New Deal. I think we realized that when we went mobilized for a global total war during World War II. I think actually, and this is maybe the good news, I think most Americans realize that today. I was just looking at surveys last couple of days on American attitudes towards shutdown rules. An overwhelming majority of Americans support them, 80%. There are actually twice as many Americans who say they think they should be more strict, 22%, than those who say that they're too strict. And I know the media doesn't present that. You know, the media is looking at the open up protesters and the pandemic people and all that stuff, right? But the fact is that most Americans actually are supportive, particularly when leaders provide consistent leadership and provide consistent messaging and are able to follow through and ensure people, at least promise them, that if everyone follows this, that we'll be out of the woods. We haven't had that kind of leadership, needless to say. And as a result, people are pessimistic, I think. People get cynical a little bit, not because they don't suspect they know what actually is needed, but because they don't see that kind of leadership being offered right now.
Yeah, I've been distinguishing, and I don't think it's overly harsh, but the difference between leadership and managers. To be a leader, you have to be able to operate on imperfect information. You have to make tough decisions. You have to stand by them. You have to be willing to admit when you're wrong. You got to course correct. There's a lot of things. I note that we have a lot of people that seem to be in manager roles, and we call them leaders, but very, very little what I would actually call leadership in a time like this. So clear, consistent messaging, a clear sense of vision and where we're going. You know, given that, I have this great faith in humans. They can do amazing things as long as they know where they're going. People will willingly take a mutter challenge where they run through the woods in 40-degree weather and get cold. And, you know, it's like nobody would ever do that if they were forced to, because they would call it a baton death march. But if it's a goal of theirs and they want to do it, my gosh, they'll crawl through mud, right?
Well, you think you're participating in something larger than yourself. I mean, it's a whole thing of esprit and it's framing. And that's what a good leader can do. Yeah. It frames, you know, a good leader can frame things in the right way to motivate people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. And I think you're right about that. And I think also a good leader knows how to take risks. You know, if you're Winston Churchill, you sometimes have to say, I know, no, a lot of people aren't going to agree with me. A lot of people think I'm making a big mistake, but I'm staking everything on this course, right? And that's what a good leader sometimes has to do.
Yeah. Well, let me talk about one institution where I lost my faith. So as we watch now, Plutarch said one of the oldest and most fatal ailments of all republics is a gap between the rich and the poor. The Federal Reserve as an institution has been given a really soft pass by the press for a long, long time, but they control something really important, which is the flow of funds into the capital system. And because of the way they've gone about doing that, it's precipitated one of the largest wealth gaps in all of history. And so at the core of the American narrative is this idea of fairness, of justice, hard work prevails, meritocracy, all of that. But from my standpoint, after studying this, Neil, the Fed is absolutely anything but a fair organization. It's redistributive in nature, and they pick winners and losers. Hey, savers, you get nothing. Banks get a lot, right? It's inherently unfair. And I think this is an awakening that needs to happen, as people need to get re-engaged with the economics, with the financial, with the monetary cycles, because it's really important what's happening. I feel like the Fed actually tossed one entire generation under the bus. That'd be the most recent generation, because they made home ownership a virtual impossibility by ramming interest rates on mortgages down as low as they could so that they could rescue housing prices, which was great for the owners of those houses. Wasn't so good for the people who wanted to start a household, right? That's picking winners and losers. And so that's an institution that I feel really has a lot to answer for in this particular part of the story where we're at. And it gets almost no focus so far, but it's starting to grow a little bit because it's...
Yeah, I think you're right. Look, I mean, the Fed, in all fairness, I agree with you overall. In all fairness to the Fed, I think it's always put in a very difficult position, because when there's a crisis, I mean, obviously massive unemployment and so on, a failure of financial institutions, causes great suffering. No one wants to repeat the 1930s if they can help it. That's sort of the example of what every policy leader is kind of the mark of failure, you know, if you let that happen. And I think, though, the problem is the Fed every time kind of raises the ante, because what it wants to do, it says, well, in order to keep the economy going, we got to keep all these large companies going. And what they do is they bail them all out and make sure they've done that big time in this last, you know, just we've seen the last 2 months with the CARES Act and the Fed's activism. They're making sure that almost no one's, you know, they're putting the economy into this kind of medical coma so that, you know, no one can go bankrupt. No one can be in default. Everyone is sort of held harmless. Everyone sort of nominally gets the same income, but they're preventing the economy from adjusting. And just like in 2008, 2009, we're going to come out of it. The same incumbents are going to be in power. And by the way, this last crisis, I don't think any economic crisis in history has more adversely affected small businesses and independent contractors so much worse than large companies who don't require personal contact and already have plenty of cash and were the first to get in line for all the PPP loans. And, you know, mm-hmm. you can just go down and name it. Mm-hmm. But these large companies are going to come out to some extent even better. A lot of their competitors are going to be slain. A lot of the small businesses that might have ever competed with them will probably go down. So this is why the S&P 500 has not gone down as much as you might have thought. It went down what? Late February to mid late March, it went down by 33%, and now it's back about half of that. Well, that's one of the weakest bear markets in history, despite one of the most catastrophic set of economic indicators coming at us, right? Mm-hmm. So isn't that a sign what the Fed is doing? And it's not just the Fed, it's Congress. I mean, it's the CARES Act. Again, during a crisis, you have sympathy with these people. They're sort of acting under duress. I mean, what else are you supposed to do? You know, you don't want to have businesses go under and throw all people out of work. I do think, though, you're absolutely right that the long-term result of this will be a massive insistence by the American public that the rules of the game be redrawn. And that's the positive aspect of a fourth turning. I will say that many people, when they read my book, you know, particularly when they read of my book before they read it, they think, oh, my God, this guy's a doomsdayer. You know, he's talking about apocalypse and so on. And actually, no, I think of the fourth turning as very restorative. The fourth turnings have to happen. They're not pleasant. But in a way, it's like forest fires or floods. You know, they clear away the underbrush and they allow the next generation to have room to grow. They tilt the playing field away from the old toward the young. They tilt it toward away from incumbents toward new people. One of the reasons why the productivity growth of the U.S. economy is slowing down, and also why the marginal return on capital is just around zero now, is that all the people who are getting high rates of return on capital are incumbents. You know, Warren Buffett would say they all have moats around them. You can't compete with them. Mm-hmm. And every time the Fed bails them out, that moat widens. You know, there's less way to compete with it. So we have this weird situation in America now where the interest rates are practically zero. These big corporate, the Fortune 500 is actually getting, or at least got until recently, very high rates of return on their actual replacement cost of capital or their market cost of capital. And yet almost no one's doing any investing. I mean, think of that. And Larry Summers actually posed it in that way. How do you explain such high returns on existing capital, zero interest rates, and no one's using that interest rates for doing, you know, no one's investing much at those low interest rates? Why? Because new creators of business can't get those returns of the incumbents. That's the reason. So we have a bifurcated market. And I think that this is what has to be broken down. And the fourth turning is, to some extent, an act of creative destruction. It destroys as much as it creates. We saw that in the 1930s. We saw that in the 1940s, which, by the way, was a period of huge shift from inequality to equality in America. I mean, if you look at, you know, Thomas Piketty and all these you know, these French communists, you know, all these guys who you know, love to talk about global equality and all that. You know, they all show, yeah, there's this huge trend toward higher inequality. But, yeah, except for that period from the late 20s to the late 40s, right? Yeah, that kind of went the other way then. To me, that's not the exception. That's the rule. Mm. In fact, there's a great book which you should look at because I know you're interested in this stuff by Walter Scheidel. It's called The Great Leveler. And he's an economic historian. He actually made his name on obscure books on Ptolemaic Egypt and, you know, the Nile economy during the 3rd century BC. It's a, you know, very, very obscure monograph. But he wrote a very important book, which actually got a fair amount of attention about 5 years ago, called The Great Leveler. And he basically says, if you go back through all of history, since the Neolithic Revolution, during times of peace and prosperity, that is to say, during the rise of any city-oriented state, you know, any state with division of labor and typically with some kind of form of money, means of transaction, during times of peace and prosperity, inequality over time always increases. It always increases. He says, there are only four things which reduce inequality through history. Total war, mm-hmm. total revolution, famines, and plagues. I mean, it sounds like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And he says, even land reform, he has an enormous appendix where he goes through all the attempts at peaceful land reform. He says, they only work if they're destructive and violent. He sort of, you know, he actually, you know, the thing, it's an interesting book. It has hundreds of footnotes. You'd enjoy it. I spoke with him. He's out of Stanford, actually. But I do think there's a broader point about inequality. And this is point about creative destruction. There has to be some destruction in there. You have to destroy the privileges. You have to destroy the sinecures. And that's never pleasant. But it's part of the process. And I've often told people if they expect to see, you know, Social Security reformed and, I don't know, global warming solved and, you know, God knows what else you're talking about on a peaceful sunny day where we're actually just feeling great about everything. We all just come into a room and says, you know, this is a great time, right? I feel good to be alive. Let's just all, you know.
Reform Social Security.
Yeah, right. That is never, ever how it happens, okay? Uh-huh. Big reforms come about during dark and stormy nights. That's the and I'm talking about big reforms, even reforms that actually commit society to huge new sacrifices. Interestingly enough, and that's a little bit counterintuitive. You might think that during a crisis, we're going to just try to get by, but you know, otherwise indulge ourselves as much as possible because everything is so bad right now. Mm-hmm. No. I mean, the original Social Security Act, which committed us to huge long-term commitments, you know, to the disabled, the poor, the, you know, poor families, poor elderly, the pay-as-you-go, just all of that stuff. It had 39 different titles to it. That was passed and enacted in 1935. That's the depths of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So there are lessons in this for history. I find fourth turnings to be very creative times where we actually undergo solving huge problems. When did we create Bretton Woods, the United Nations, the IMF, the World Bank? You know, we created this whole globalized system of trade, dollar gold stamp, just all of the stuff that they did. You know, all these great planners, which enabled us decades of prosperity, right, and growing division of labor and affluence. We created it actually in the latter days of the World War II. That's when we laid out all the plans. So anyway, I don't know, but that's a different way of looking at it. I'm posing a little bit of a different way of looking at how we actually move forward creatively into the future versus how we might imagine it would be in the best of all possible world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this all dovetails, I guess I came to it sort of an intuitive basis, but I pieced it together from a lot of different sources, including the fourth turning, which is I talk about the need for people to be resilient. And this is a great time to be resilient, this next 10 years in particular, you know, and I've been trying to nudge, cajole, and walk people towards that. And in our model, we have 8 forms of capital that people should be resilient in. You know, none are so poor as those who only have money, but having money and managing your financial wealth and capital is important. Your social capital is very important as well. Your emotional capital, exceedingly important. Your spiritual capital. These are the things that will help you succeed and even thrive when other people are having a really tough time of it. And so I feel sort of in the Nassim Taleb piece that we sort of became fragile. Our complexity worked against us to a point in time. And so you have all these things sort of converging at once, a hyper interconnected, but overly complicated and complex world. And complex, I mean, unpredictable, has emergent behaviors. You can't really say what's going to happen through a model, right? Stuff just occurs. Within that framework, though, you keep mentioning this idea, the total war is a hallmark of a fourth turning. Can you talk about that in the context of the next 10 years?
Well, you know, total war is it's interesting. It's more of a metaphor embodied in a sense of urgency, right? I mean, right now, how many leaders around the world saying we're at war with a pandemic, right? I mean, look at Emmanuel Macron, you know, we're engaged with a war. This is a moment of truth. So we have to marshal all of our national abilities, right? So that's in a sense, I mean, the fact that it has to be a violent war, I hope not. Although I will say most of the fourth turnings in our history actually do tend to be violent. I don't think that's necessarily the case. But I think urgency and a sense of peril, in other words, you have to do this or if you don't, very big and bad things are going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's what's required. And also the sense of, you know, warfare is interesting in one regard. It is the total mobilization of society for very specific purposes. Rarely happens, right? Peacetime society, that never really happens, right? We just sort of, individuals just sort of transact and do whatever they want, and things just evolve, you know, in some sort of, hopefully with some sort of invisible hand guiding it. Mm-hmm. But warfare is very interesting in that, and it involves just a huge amount of top-down planning. It's also very associated necessarily with declining inequality, because the first thing we usually do in wars is tax. And we usually start with taxing the people who immediately have resources, right? And you can see where that goes. Revolution and war usually involve the regimenting of society to specific goals that society needs to have in order to meet some particular end. I think there's certain aspects of this COVID-19 crisis which actually conforms to that idea. In particular, this whole idea that you can't do piecemeal. One thing about war is you can't do it. You can't do war piecemeal. You can't say, well, we're going to go war with Japan or other fascists, but you know, only about 10%. You know, you can't do it. It's an all or nothing decision, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's very interesting that dealing with the pandemic has that quality. As you know, Chris, there are two basic strategies for getting through the pandemic. There's kind of the, you know, there's the kind of the Netherlands-Swedish plan of pursue herd immunity, which is basically pretty laissez-faire, except, you know, get all the old people out of the way, or maybe send all the pre-existing conditioned people to an island somewhere. But it does involve some planning, but it's a little bit more laissez-faire. The other involves a lot more top-down direction, it's containment. You can either go one way or the other. They're actually pretty interesting and sophisticated arguments in favor of the herd immunity idea, although I think fundamentally it's not really workable and at a permissible cost. But I will say this, you've got to choose either one strategy or the other. If you're sitting there in the middle, mm-hmm. right, with an R naught of around one, and every time you go under one, you open up the economy again, then you go back to one and over it, and then you shut it down again. You're like a sailboat that's directly into the wind and can't decide which way to tack. Mm-hmm. You're actually in the worst possible long-term position. And unfortunately, that's where the United States is.
That's true.
We can't decide to pursue real containment, and we can't decide to pursue herd immunity. Either one of those would be a gutsy call. I mean, herd immunity would be a gutsy call. I would respect it if we had leadership for it. It would be like shooting the rapids, right?
Yep.
You'd really have to plan for that, but you could do it. It is a plan. It is a strategy. What we're doing now is not a strategy at all. It's just going in and out and in and out. We're going to have rolling waves of this thing. It's going to be like 1918. This is going to go on for the next, you know, year and a half. And we're going to have rolling waves of this come back in June. We'll see what that does to the stock market. But I tell you, given the fact that most Americans support containment, when those infections begin to rise again, there's going to be hell to pay politically. Because suddenly Americans will say, you mean we have to go back and regain all the ground we lost?
Yep. And if we were really going to war game this out, I would try and run that herd immunity experiment in a statistically relevant sample. Let's call it Atlanta or New Hampshire or some place where you could say, you know, put your hand up. Who wants to give this a go? And I bet you'd find a locality who would say, we'd give that a go. Because here's what we still don't know. We don't know if you can get long-lasting immunity to this particular bug. We don't know what happens if it mutates a little bit and you have antibody-dependent enhancement pathways for a secondary infection that looks like, oh, that dreaded, you know, dengue. We don't know. So that leadership, you're going to have to go on imperfect information, try it out and all of that. But you're right. You got to pick one way or the other. And I think we have very different strategies in Massachusetts versus Georgia, but we still have interstate transport operating between the two locations. So it's everything all at once.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, antibody-dependent enhancement, cross-reactivities, all of this stuff is one of the reasons why I think vaccines are further off than people think. And the problem is you need time. And, it's not just regulations. You need time to assess the effect. And I keep telling people, you can't speed up time. You can get rid of the FDA regulations. You can have challenge trials. You know, you can start giving these vaccines to millennials and actually exposing them to COVID. You know, let's hurry that. You can do all that, right? But you can't fully assess the effects without time, right? I think you'd agree. And that's part of the problem with this holy grail. I mean, the holy grail for someone who doesn't want to deal with this crisis is either we're going to have herd immunity quickly or we're going to have some, you know, antiviral or vaccine quickly. We're not going to have either of those quickly. So we should be getting used to that and dealing with what's right in front of us.
Yeah. Neil, I'm wondering as well in the overlay, every generation sort of has this repeating motif over time. But as we look at this most recent generation that you know, anybody who was born after whatever that number is, let's call it 2000-ish, you had an iPad in your hands. You had a screen in your hands. You had this technology overlay that really gave a, it seems to, I'm not sure what the actual characteristic of this generation is supposed to be, but I get this sense of isolation and loneliness. All of the polls that we've conducted at Peak Prosperity or that I read about, people in the audiences who come to listen to me, they self-report like isolation and this sense of being disconnected from their neighbors and from others is a really powerful sort of piece that I think was the dark side of this technology that we love, right? So everything, I always see everything with two-edged swords. And so I'm wondering how, in terms of this generation that needs to pick up the pieces and be the ones who are going to really do this reforming, how does the technology they grew up with either enhance or hinder that particular
tasks? My attitude to technology is a little bit different. I always think that technology is more shaped by generations than it shapes generations. Meaning that each generation takes the technology that's out there and shapes it to its own purposes. It's very interesting that boomers coming of age, you know, with Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and been at the personal computer, right? Mm-hmm. Perfect for individuals, right? We didn't want mainframes, right? We didn't want A-form organizations that, you know, you fed the data to the top and some, you remember back in the late 60s, that was the paradigm. No one had any other paradigm for computers. Mm-hmm. There were big machines that worked for institutions. The whole idea that an individual would have access, it just wasn't an accessible idea to the generation at the time. Boomers invented that, and they pushed it, and they pursued it, and they popularized it, and they started individuating society. I think Gen X took that further and started making a lot of money with companies like Google and Amazon and, you know, all the X-ray-led companies today. So I think these two generations have taken technology and hugely individuated it. I think what's interesting about millennials is they're taking the technology and they're moving it back to the group. I mean, the whole idea of social media, the whole idea of, you know, Zuckerberg's whole company. But the whole idea of using technology to bring us back together. Remember when back in, what was it, Friendster and MySpace? You remember all those original social media? They weren't called social media. Yep. They're sort of bulletin board companies. You went under avatars like Donald Duck. You know, no one went under their personal identity. Mm-hmm. And it was just for having fun. Millennials go into their personal identity. They actually want to connect that way. And the other thing millennials have been doing is that they've been pushing a renaissance in extended family living in America. I mean, this is a generation which, as they get older and older and older, they're still living with their parents. Mm-hmm. Even when they have jobs, even when they have income, they're still living either near with their parents. This generation has a great personal relationship with their boomer parents as they grow older. And now this is just accelerating it. Look today at all the millennials, you know, in their mid-30s who are going back home now, right? So we're going to see the same thing we saw during the Great Depression, which is this huge movement back of families living together. And one thing that's going to do, by the way, is it's going to replace a lot of marketable GDP. And I think that's one other long-term hurdle for the economy. We have become, with boomers and Xers, what I sometimes call the blow-dry economy. You know, we each pay each other to blow dry each other's hair. I mean, we pay each other to make each other's food, to launder each other's laundry, to raise each other's kids. I mean, right. Think about it. Mm-hmm. This extreme individualism has led us to create market transactions for everything that we don't want to do. Even things that just in passing, we don't feel we want to do. Mm-hmm. What are we doing now with everyone living at home? We've already seen this growing with millennials. Now it's hugely growing, right? With all these families now living together, they are actually taking all these services that used to be done in the marketplace and they're doing at home. We're eating better. Why? Because we're not cooking our own food. Mm-hmm. I think we're raising our kids better. Because why? Because our kids aren't, you know, being babysat by some school. They're actually at home, maybe learning something from their parents. And I could go down the line, but I do think that this will lead to actually, it had the same function during the Great Depression, by the way. We came out of the Great Depression using far less servants, you know, in our households. You know, we created a middle class, which had, you know, could create their own households. I do think that this is an extremely healthy development. And I do think of all generations today, millennials most crave community. You see them in big cities. They all live 3 and 4 with each other. They live with their parents. They're close to their parents. I mean, millennials will tell you that again and again. We've done surveys on that. I've written several pieces on, you know, loneliness as a pathology. And how boomers, one generation that interestingly pioneered a lot more people living alone, interestingly, was the GI generation after World War II, once it reached retirement. Because with Social Security and all the entitlements, for the first time ever in history, old people could live alone. So that was kind of the pioneer. And then later on, boomers were into, you know, what's called solo living. You know, boomers do everything alone. You know, they have serial marriages, serial religions. You know, they're always moving on from one thing to another. And Xers have made a religion out of being alone. Part of the reason they have to be so resilient and anti-fragile is because they're alone all the time. They have to, like, brace their lives, you know. But anyway, I think millennials are really moving America in another direction. This is a generation which, precisely because they don't trust individuals in the marketplace being able to replace community. They think you actually have to go out of the way and actually create community. And that's, by the way, why when you survey millennials on their political choices, 2/3 of them vote for the party of community, which right now happens to be defined as the Democratic Party, which is why this generation is so, you know, Democratic leaning right now. I do many surveys on people of all ages by political attitudes, and I find that is the most, that is actually the best single question that differentiates people under 30 from people over 50. It's a very simple question. You give people a choice. I believe the government should, and then give them a choice. reinforce the principle of self-reliance, reinforce the principle of community. That generates a 30 percentage point split between people over 50 who are all self-reliance, you know, they're all individualists, they're all there with Frank Waldo Emerson, right? Mm-hmm. And then you got people under 30, they all want community. Now, if you had gotten back to about 1970 or 1960, you probably would have seen the opposite split, right? Uh-huh. Younger people would have wanted individualism and older people favored community. Hmm. But that's generational change for you, Chris.
So as we look into the future with that, you just mentioned that there's probably a significant change in GDP because of that that tendency to live at home, you know, not forming a household. So let me make it personal. I got my license within 7 days of turning 16, got my first $500 beater car as fast as I could, and I was out of there. Woo, right? None of my kids are doing that, right? They're all like, you know, very lackadaisical, you know, getting their license at 18, 19, 20, whatever, doesn't matter to them. Not really needing cars, all that stuff, right? So I see that already showing up. And now we overlay this whole COVID thing, right? I can tell you, Neil, that I'm permanently changed. It's going to take a long time before I get on a cruise ship again, right? Even if some vaccine comes along, right? You know, or take flights in the same way. And I see as well, our surveys are showing up that people, a lot of them have said, wow, turns out I didn't realize how much I hated that life I used to have. I actually like this working from home or being home thing. And I'm just wondering how much you think that COVID has given sort of that ability for people to see themselves in a new life, and that may stick for some portion of them.
That's just what I was arguing. I mean, I think this is going to be a new, this is going to set a new pathway. It's a pathway that we wanted to move to anyway. That's kind of my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
People wanted this community. People weren't satisfied with these isolated nuclear families, these isolated living patterns. I think our method of you know, land management in America is crazy. It's just endless strip malls. I mean, you go certain areas of this country, it's, you know, who designed that? Well, that's a problem. No one designed it that way.
Yeah.
Right? Again, yeah. Community. The GI generation used to go out and they designed things. They said, this is how it's going to be. We're going to have a community that looks like this, you know? No, with boomers and Xers, it's just however it happens. I use a paradigm from Talcott Parsons, he's forgotten now, but he was a great sociologist in the 1950s. And Talcott Parsons used to say that any society goes through four phases, right? And then the first phase, he describes each phase in terms of supply and demand for social order. And he said and this kind of roughly lines up with my turnings. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the first phase is a high demand for order, and institutions have a high supply of order. You know, and everyone's pretty happy with that. That would be the American high, right? In the second phase, the institutions are still supplying a lot of order, but there's less demand for it from individuals. That would have been the awakening, right? I mean, all these institutions are telling you, you know, get back in line, kid, and go to the Vietnam War and, you know, organize your life like this, and young people weren't buying it. In fact, people of all generations no longer were buying into it. That would have been the awakening. In the third phase, which is the third turning, there's still no demand for order, but institutions no longer supply it either. So everyone's happy with that. It's kind of like, you know, Reagan in America, you know, so it's like, well, we're not going to tell you what to do, and you don't want to be told what to do. So we're all good with that, right? Mm-hmm. You know? use a popular expression. It's what I want to do, deal with it, you know? So we're all happy with that. But the fourth turning is when, institutions aren't supplying order, but people start demanding it again. See the difference? Mm-hmm. That's where we are right now. People want some sort of design again in their social life, their civic life, their community life. And the number one generation for that, I think, is millennials.
Hmm. Hmm. Well, that is absolutely fascinating. And this is all the time we have for today. I'm going to leave it there. But before we go, the fourth turning, of course, we're going to provide a link for the book. Everybody should read it. I recommend it all the time. It's on our permanent recommended reading list at Peak Prosperity. But Neil, other things that you're working on right now would include?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a new book, sort of take the fourth turning up to date. One of my frustrations as history begins to quicken is more and more often the fourth turning goes out of print. So this happened in 2016, you know, with and then it happened again. It's happening now. I mean, the publisher's fighting to get it back in because there's been a run on the book. Mm-hmm. But we're going for a new book, which really discusses in depth exactly how the 2020s are going to play out. I will just say that anyone who's really interested in this, particularly, you know, demography and sort of what my take is on how things are playing out, particularly generationally, I do have I'm head of demography at Hedge Eye Risk Management, and I have a team there, and we actually have a retail product which you can sign up for called Demography Unplugged. And if you just go on Google and Google Demography Unplugged, that'll take you right there. So anyone who's interested can go on, and it's really interesting. I do a podcast once a week. I do a weekly COVID call. I do a newswire that comes out on Monday, and a bunch of special interviews and stuff.
Good. And how would people tune into those weekly calls?
They would go Demography Unplugged and subscribe. Okay. And once you're subscribed, you get everything. You know, it all comes to your email address. It's a personal product. We do institutional stuff too, but I don't think individuals probably want to sign up for that. But there's been a lot of demand just from individuals. People, as just individuals, say, you know, I really want to follow what you're doing, what you're saying, what your next book. And you can also follow me, by the way, on How Generation on Twitter. And of course, you don't need to pay anything for that, you know. So we often put out some stuff there that we're working on and a lot of chatter there.
Well, good. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for all your work that you've been doing there. We'll certainly direct people to that. And I know our audience is very, very interested in what your insights would be for 2020 going forward. So with that, Neil, thank you so much for your time today.
Great. Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure.